So good evening, everybody. If anyone is here for the first time, welcome. Thank you for joining us. When most human beings encounter difficulties, hardships, ups and downs in their life, there's two basic responses that often arise when these hardships or difficulties... Can you hear me okay in the back? Okay, great. If that gets difficult, just go like that again. When these hardships become present enough for a human being, two typical responses tend to arise. One is bewilderment. Bewilderment in the form of what is happening? Why is this happening? Why is this happening to me? What am I going to do about this? And so forth. One response, bewilderment. Another very, very common response is to seek something beyond the bewilderment. And this seeking can arise even as the bewilderment is there, even in the midst of the confusion, the not understanding, the unsettledness, the suffering. This seeking something beyond the suffering, something beyond the trouble, something beyond the stress can arise. And sometimes it arises unbeknownst to the so-called person. All they're seeing, all they're experiencing is this difficulty and bewilderment about it. Do you know anybody who's exempt from what I'm talking about? Where is there an exception to what I'm describing? We'd be hard put to find one, wouldn't we? If you listen to what people are experiencing, and they're telling you honestly what's going on, because some people aren't telling you honestly what's going on. Some people aren't even talking about what's going on with them. And that's okay, but it's different than somebody who's talking about what's actually going on for them as they experience themselves. When someone's talking about what they're actually experiencing, it doesn't take too long within that to hear something in there that could be described as unsatisfactory. Or to change the terminology a little bit, unreliable. If we come right in through the window of physics, we don't have to go very far to see that we're in a field of relativity. And that things are unreliable, meaning that they change. One moment you could rely upon this particular thing, and the next moment you can't. Even your best friends, as I often find, forget to call you. Sometimes even after they said they would. Oh yes, I'll send you an email. I guess they're not my friend. They forgot about me. And you yourself might do it. Yes, I'll do this. I'll do this for you. And you forget. Not because you're malicious, but because you forgot. You got busy. You can't even get the same sweetness out of the same bushel of oranges. This orange tasted like this, and this orange tasted, if you checked it out closely, a little different. Unreliability. When people hear, many times, when people hear that what the Buddha inserted into this perpetual wandering that human beings are about until they're not, the first noble truth, which is the truth of unreliability, the way it got translated somewhere back there, who knows where in time, was the first noble truth is life is suffering. And right there, many people go, that's not for me. Not interested in that. That's negative. It's pejorative. Those Buddhists, they're all lost in suffering. Or trying to escape it. I, on the other hand, am going to do something different. Good luck. He was so precise, the historical Buddha was, when he saw this, and who knows how that actually happened, because we weren't there. It happened, as the legend has told us, that he saw this truly, deeply, experientially. And why did he put that as the first of the four great truths or noble truths? Why did he say life is suffering? Perhaps he said that because most people have a deep, deep, interior, intrinsic, unconscious resistance in the form of fear, in the form of aversion, in the form of bewilderment, to unreliability. Because if you take the original term dukkha, which is a Pali Buddhist word that could be translated as suffering, you find that the word can equally be translated as unreliability. And it could also be equally translated as unsatisfactoriness. Now, deep inside, and not necessarily just deep inside, somewhere there in everyone, even as this bewilderment may be going on and the seeking of something beyond it, there is this search for satisfaction. There's this search for happiness. And one looks at other people sometimes and goes, that person seems to have more happiness than me. They seem happier in this culture on planet Earth than in that culture. A friend of mine just came back from Germany, where he'd very much like to move. And when I look at him, I think he looks German. The head is nicely shaved, a little bit of mustache, the little bit of the goatee-ish look. The shape of the head, I haven't asked him, do you have German ancestry in the bloodline? But he wants to move to Germany. Why does he want to move to Germany? Because he says, in this particular town which he's found, which he thinks the Yankees are going to destroy when they find it, it's very pastoral, and the city is set up so that hardly anybody drives a car. And they walk out and they hang out with one another in the evening, in the breakfast time, any time of day, and they're hanging out. And if you're hanging out, he says, and you're just there, people don't leave you alone. They don't just walk by, he says. They come up and they interact with you. Hello. They interact. Hi. And he knows some German. And so that helps. He says, I want to move there because I feel connected. He goes, my neighbors never come out of their house in Newbury, Florida. I've never seen them. There's their car, and there's their house, and I never see them. I have some people on my street I've never seen. How do I even know they're there? The house looks inhabited. The grass gets mowed. There's about 20 houses on my street. I don't know who lives in that house. Is that a tragedy? Is that a condition of a certain kind of architecture, mindset, consciousness? Is it the weather? I want to move to Germany, he says, because I feel connected. Meanwhile, the suffering is right there in the discourse that he's giving. Everybody's giving a discourse, right? Even though they might think of it as a monologue, it's their monologic discourse on what's going on, what's important to them. In that monologic discourse of his, he inserts the line, and you could feel the suffering if you were there, just like I did. The Yanks are going to wreck it. Because his view is Americans ruin everything once they get a hold of it long enough. This unreliability is a very, very precious friend. It's not an enemy. It's not something to be avoided. It's not something to deny. It's not something that you must develop defense mechanisms against. Some people, when they get connected with another human being, they get bonded, they fall into some kind of lovingness. They also get clingy and they get attached and they get needy. They don't want the other to go too far away. And sometimes they start to act in an annoying manner when the other is going a little too far away. Because they found something there. Something's happening that's worth holding on to. Can I ask you now, is there anything worth holding on to? Really? Is there anything worth holding on to? When I stop talking, if that's stuck at all, we can talk about that. You can tell me, tell us, what you found in this world that's truly worth holding on to. And I mean holding on really tight. Don't let it go. Don't let it go. Don't let it go. The first noble or great truth says life is unreliable. We're talking the field of relativity. The person or personality is a manifestation of relativity. The mind, the thoughts, feelings, the breathing, the sensations, the bodily functions, the behavior is an expression of the field of relativity. So these particles that make up the air, clouds, the earth itself, it's relative. This thing didn't exist at one time, so to speak. It appeared. So did we. Life is manifesting constantly as living and dying simultaneously. We often associate to the living side of that more than the so-called dying side, because we've separated the two. There's living and there's dying. And they do not mean the same thing. And we have a whole other set of associations that go with living and a whole other assorted set of associations that go with dying. And they're not connected. Or they are connected, that when this ends, this living ends, then there's dying. Or even solidify it more, and the human says, that when this living ends, there's death. And we have a whole set of associations, feelings, beliefs, ideas, projections about that, as we do about life. What happens when there's a true investigation, which is what meditation is about, is truly investigating what's happening, truly being here for this confusion and bewilderment and unreliability. And to see into it, to discover what a noble truth really is. Because it's different than a truth, like that your knees are bent, or that your head is tilted, or that you ate ice cream before dinner when you were wanting something sweet before the tofu or the turkey or whatever you eat. Because you just couldn't wait. We waited until after. That's the truth. Okay, I ate ice cream. Noble truth is something different. Noble truth is a truth that when understood, meaning lived, it liberates the human being from what? From the bewilderment, from the confusion, from the not understanding, from the stress, from the trouble, from the strife. Now we're starting to get into the second and third noble truths. The second noble truth, this actually wasn't going to be a talk on the truths, but let me do a little bit more. The second noble truth is that there's a cause for this unreliability, this unsatisfactoriness. Let's go straight at it. There's a cause for this unhappiness, this suffering. And there's relief from that. Here's the third noble truth. There's relief, there's cessation from that plight, from that pathos. And you can find cessation as a truth, and even a noble truth, when you discover that the sting of the insect bite goes away by itself. You don't even have to scratch it, which I just did. I was in Mexico once, out in this island, Cozumel, which is out on the Yucatan Peninsula. We're camping out on Cozumel. And we got out there by boat, and it was about this time. The sun was just going down. We were getting ready to set up the tents on a beach, lovely beach. Can you see it now? The worn-out boat sitting there. It's a piece of art. It's rotting on the beach. It's a piece of art. Different color woods. Paint peeling off. Waves lapping in. Quiet. No one else around. Go to set up the tents. And there is a swarm, I mean a mass, of mosquitoes like you wouldn't believe. They just descend upon us. It's amazing. It's like attacked. We are here to eat you. And we're scrambling, and I'm running out on the pier to try to get out into the water a little bit. And then I'm running back, and I'm thinking, the best way to handle this is just keep running. I'll put a stake in, and then I'll run. And I'll do this, and then I'll run. And I'll do this, and then I'll run. And finally, I was just like, you can have me. I might keep doing this a little bit, but you know what? I'm going to just do this. You can have me. And now you can have this huge itch. And for some people, that would be a dangerous situation. They might develop some kind of very severe reaction. Could die or something even. It's unreliable. Beautiful beach. Beautiful waves. Beautiful boat. Beautiful atmosphere. And it comes. You get into this meditative pose, you get centered, you get relaxed, you get quiet, you get peaceful, you get still, you get tranquil, you get happy, you get loving, your heart goes, ooh, boy, there's no edge out here. Wow. I love everything. And then, boom, it changes. It changes so fast sometimes. You didn't even see a change. All of a sudden, it's different, and you didn't even see how it got that way. In fact, as the meditation deepens, things happen faster and faster. That doesn't mean you're moving around faster and faster, but the way that this unreliability, this change, actually is experienced is increasingly rapid. And you begin to get a sense experientially of what the physicists have been looking at for a while now when they're talking about how fast the universe, the universes, are moving. I don't know the figure, but this thing we're sitting on is flying through space right now. And I don't just mean like sliding slowly. It's flying through space. And we're sitting here on it. It's a perception, isn't it, that we're sitting still? So some people, when they encounter that bewilderment, before the seeking, something beyond the bewilderment even arises, they just pull back. That didn't feel good. That didn't look good. I didn't like that. Detour. Just curve right out of there. The only problem is that as that person goes to curve right out of there, not the only problem, but a problem, is that they find that when they go over here, eventually, sooner or later, they encounter something of the same experience. Never quite the same, but they once again encounter unreliability. Let me go here, unreliable. Let me go here, unreliable. Let me go here, let me go here, let me go here. Where do I find satisfaction? That's the seeker. That's the seeker coming through that says, where do I find satisfaction? Am I going to find it when somebody remembers my birthday? When enough people remember it? When I turned 40, there was this huge party that happened. First time in my life. It was like I came home from work and there was like 50 or 60 cars all over the neighborhood. Up by the people's house where I don't know them. We took over the street. I came in and it was all these people. On my 50th anniversary, birthday. I haven't been married for 50 years. Freudian slip. Nobody came. And the 50, right? The 50 is supposed to be a biggie. It's supposed to be bigger than the 40. Who said so? Somebody. Enough people. And then 60. Oh, boy. 60. That's a real biggie. And then they forget about you at 70. Because it's your birthday, they say. They say. It's your birthday, the day you were born. Nobody knows until they investigate who was born or who was not born, but we go ahead and agree, you were born. And it's the celebratory day. And if you can't be happy and have fun on your birthday, when are you going to have it? And yet that happiness, and 50 people come, or 60 people come, or nobody comes, and you just have that cake with one candle, and it's perfectly fine. That happiness, no judgment here, but that happiness is completely and totally transitory. The seeker, the one coming up through that fog of bewilderment, wants a happiness that is not transitory. Because that seeker is seeking him or herself. Only problem is, or a problem is, that that seeker is going out, going over to, looking for themselves. Isn't that funny? Looking for themselves. They don't know who they are, but yet they're looking for themselves. And most human beings benefit at different points in their life from a structured, scientific, artistic, creative, compassionate, full of wisdom methodology that can help them look deeply, that means seek deeply, until the seeker's gone. Because what the seeker is actually seeking is his or her own dissolution. What we are, in one sense, is the space that everything is happening in. Just notice that right now here. The space that everything is happening in. That can't be realized when you, so to speak, are busy identifying with being aware. Being aware that I am the space that everything happens in. That blocks it. Notice how the space cannot be pinned down in any way. Can't be localized. Can't be grasped. Can't be held on to. Can't be owned. The seeker is actually seeking complete poverty. Complete loss of all ownership. Poverty gets a bad rap. Some, I would say, fairly thoughtful human beings, compassionate human beings, lawful human beings, as we speak, are busy, very busy, trying to bring the head of the country of Sudan to trial for genocide. A newspaper photograph shows the smiling face of the head of the country of Sudan. He's wearing furs, white, mink, maybe. He's got a group, entourage around, and they're all smiling. He's talking on his cell phone. Big smile on the face, caption underneath. Court in The Hague. I don't know their name for sure. They're trying to bring him to trial. He's going for his happiness. He's going for his power. He's going for his continued leadership. And wants to ensure that nobody can knock him off. It's an odd photograph for myself to look at. Serious photograph. Disturbing photograph. That happiness that the seeker is seeking, where is it? Can the seeker find it? And if so, where? The legacy and the teachings say, it's not out there. Look inside. Go inward. Meditate. Investigate. Go inside. For some people, that look inside doesn't even begin until they've exhausted quite a few of the so-called possibilities out there. And even when they've gone inside for a while, sometimes they pop right out and find, you know what, I think I'll try it again out there. We're quite helpless about this arising and bewilderment in relation to unreliability, and also the seeking that arises up through that bewilderment. That's a good thing. It's a good thing that we're helpless. Good thing we realize that we're not in control. The more deeply we realize we're not in control, the more real becomes the possibility and reality of insight into what letting go really means. Prior to that, the seeker can be busy trying to figure out how to let go. Let go enough. Let go fully. Because the teachings have said, if there's complete letting go, then everything is yours. Think about that for a second. That which is clung on to, here's the second tendency in the humans, once the suffering has arisen, the tendency to attach or to cling to that which is satisfactory, temporal, transitory as it is, generates a suffering, an unhappiness, and a narrowing of experience. Meanwhile, one could be saying, well, I would like to be truly open. I would like to be one with everything. You can't be one with everything because you already are. You can't become one with everything because you already are. You can't find a home someplace else because it's already here. You can't figure out what you are because what you are is already here. But it's obscured, this is what the Buddha was very, very clear about, it's obscured because of this trance induction born from encountering the First Noble Truth and then seeking something beyond it. But if you must do this, you must do it. You must seek. You can't help it. Just like for some human beings, when they're turned on to this sense that growth, growing, developing, evolving is part of life, and to be stuck, to be confined, is unacceptable. George Bush just came out and said, it's unacceptable to the American people and to myself that we don't drill out in the oceans for the oil. We've got to get it. Because the pump price is too high. We've got to get that oil. Came out just today or yesterday. Popped it onto the front page because you're capable of getting the front page of a lot of newspapers when you say something like that as the president. It's unacceptable that we don't go out there and drill. Disturbing comment. Especially when you look at the facts. How long that oil is going to last. How many creatures are going to die if we go after that. And so we have this movement to float. Reduce. Reuse. Recycle. What's the most powerful word in those three? Reduce. What happens as the awakening impulse comes is there's a reduction in the need. I mean the need. Not just the desire, the need for the seeker to find the solution. Because the seeker is not going to find the solution. The seeker's very presence is obscuring the solution. But he/she doesn't know it. So he/she must go around and look. Is my happiness here? Is my happiness here? Is my happiness here? Is my happiness here? Where is home? And that's okay. It has to happen. At some point. That, you could say, winds down. And there can be a moment, an instant. And most human beings have had this, whether it's been very clear or not. Varies. Seeker's gone. Bewilderment's gone. There is no confusion. There is no misunderstanding. There is no seeking. There is no problem. There is no problem anywhere. And the eyes might go like this. I found it. Did you? Poof! I found it. Poof! It goes away. the seeker goes. Flip it over. Okay, I'm not going to seek. Seeking won't work. I'm not going to seek. So what are you going to do? What are you going to do? I'm going to sit around and not seek. You can't make me. It's like holding your breath in kindergarten, which I did once. I went, I don't like what's happening here. And this force just blew through, right? That's what's happening, folks. The force of life is blowing its wind through everything, as everything. And we are that. It's a false dichotomy to say, okay, field of relativity sitting within the ultimate. Field of relativity sitting within the eternal. Field of relativity sitting within the absolute. If you listen to people talking about these kinds of matters that I'm sharing about, you will hear this dichotomy drawn out. You are the absolute, but the relative appears within. Don't identify with your personhood, with your body, with your sexuality, with your behavior, with your hair, with your skin, your age. Don't identify with that. Rest in the absolute. How do you do that? How do you rest in the absolute? Do you ever meet anybody who says, you say to them, how you doing? Great, I'm resting in the absolute. I just found it after lunch and I'm resting in the absolute. Come on over and join me. We're having a pool party in the absolute. I can only imagine the indescribable happiness and joy that the historical Buddha was sitting in, was being, when he sat, as it has been told to us, for somewhere in the range of 2 weeks, 14 days, under the Bodhi tree, and as it's been told to us, in utter sheer, complete gratitude to the tree. If you can sit in a second, a millisecond of complete and utter gratitude to a tree, what's realized is that that gratitude is for everything, not just the tree. The happiness of the senses, pretty nice even if it's not your birthday. The happiness of concentration, oh, it goes beyond the happiness of the senses. To experience equanimity, tranquility, equipoise, silence of mind, no need to move. Happiness goes well beyond any taste, smell, sight, touch, or body sensation of pleasure. It's so clear. And then it goes poof. So what happiness is our true home? One and only. It's the happiness of realization. It's the happiness of the realization of what you really are, which in words is indescribable. And thus, at times, the word can only point, like the finger pointing to the moon, as the Zen koan has it, the finger pointing to the moon. Why is the finger pointing to the moon? One could say, so we look at the moon. The word isn't the moon. The finger pointing isn't the moon. And yet the moon exists. As both the relative and the ultimate simultaneously. That's its radiance. Lots of help involved, huh? Because that moon doesn't shine without the sun. And this planet right here, this body, doesn't thrive, doesn't live for more than just a short period of time as it's living right now without the sun. The sun is a literal and metaphorical center that we can take something from, not just its warmth. Find that sun as your own being. That's the radiance that comes up through the bewilderment, that comes up through the seeker, that eventually dissolves the need to seek. Because you can't take yourself out of seeking. But that radiance, somehow, mysteriously, has that power. Okay, let me stop right here.